It is true that the term separation of church and state does not appear in the U.S. Constitution, but that First Amendment is clear that Congress won't make laws establishing a religion or keeping people from practicing a religion. Court decisions to further define what that means have generally set religion outside the public realm. So we have Christmas manger scenes banned from public buildings, and yet still have money printed with "In God We Trust." Confused? Americans United for Separation of Church and State is not. The group pushes a very clear boundaries between religion and government. Rob Boston is the communications director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, based in Washington, D.C. He's speaking tonight at 7 at the Rogue Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Ashland. Rob Boston, thanks for joining us in the studio.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
So yours is not by far the only church-state separation group. What would you say is your main focus and the difference between yours and others?
The interesting thing about Americans United is that we are multi-faith, multi-philosophy. So we come at this question of separation of church and state by bringing people together, religious people, non-religious people. We don't have a theological axe to grind. And also, I'd say one difference between us and some other groups is that this is our main and only focus. We're on separation of church and state like a laser beam. That's all we do. There are a lot of groups out there like the American Civil Liberties Union that touch on this, and they do great work, but they're doing other things too. This is our 100% primary mission.
And your president is a minister, I notice.
Well, the former director of Americans United, Barry Lynn, was a United Church of Christ minister. He retired last year after 25 years of service. Barry was a great guy. He's been replaced by Rachel Lazar, who is the first woman to run Americans United and the first non-Christian. She's Jewish. So we are experiencing a change right now, but I think it's a very good and exciting change.
So is the group less about keeping religion out of government than the other way around?
I think it's pretty much a 50-50 balance there. The idea of separation of church and state, I think, helps religion, obviously, because it allows religion to be independent, to prosper, to grow, to seek its support from people voluntarily without the ties of the state or the oversight of the government. Yet at the same time, it also ensures that we're not living under somebody else's theology. In the United States, laws should have a secular basis. And if you can't prove that secular basis, then I think the law has to fail. It can be seen as a violation of separation of church and state.
You know, I hadn't thought about it in that context, I guess, but the fact is that if you have one faith saying, well, you know, our country was based upon this faith, and the other faiths have a reason to go, oh, excuse me a second, not quite the case.
Yeah, you know, we don't all agree on these things, and that's one of the reasons why we have so many different religions in the United States. No, I think that's interesting. I think that diversity is fascinating, and I think the way that we have evolved over a couple of hundreds of years of our history from a nation with just a handful of Protestant denominations to the thousands of Christian and non-Christian faiths that we have, and people sort of doing their own thing now. You know, you hear people talking about being spiritual but not religious. You hear people talk about the rise of the nuns, you know, not the Catholic nuns, but the N-O-N-E-S nuns who don't have a religion but are still interested in the main in spiritual things. That's what separation of church and state, I think, has done for us. It's created just an incredible diversity that I welcome and embrace.
How do you make the division, though, between the people who point out accurately that the people who founded the Republic were nominally Christian, between that and the distinction where people say, well, this country was founded on Christian principles?
The really interesting thing about some of the history is how fervent some Christian ministers were back in the day about the need for separation of church and state. I mean, you have to remember, you're seeing these people coming out of their experiences were European history, which was a lot closer to them than it is to us now. The violence, the bloodshed, the religious wars. They were, you know, intimately familiar with what that combination of church and state had done. Also, in a lot of the colonies, there were established churches. You know, Massachusetts Bay Colony was theocratic and intolerant. And a lot of these ministers back in the day, they knew about that history too. So they advocated for separation of church and state almost as a theological principle. And one of my favorites is a guy named John Leland, who was a Baptist minister, fiery Baptist minister, a cleric who believed strongly in his religious belief, you know, that his religious beliefs were true, but advocated for absolute separation and freedom of conscience for everyone. He once said, "The notion of a Christian commonwealth should be exploded forever." And he was a friend of Thomas Jefferson and a strong advocate of separation. So you had that clergy being involved there in a very important and sometimes overlooked part of our history.
As people of faith, are you surprised or otherwise taken aback by how some other organizations, some churches, some not, do think that God belongs in schools and capitals?
I think the mistake a lot of folks make is assuming that the religion that will be endorsed by the government or promoted by the government will always be their own. I get amused by this claim that people make sometimes that we're a Christian nation. Well, what version of Christianity are you talking about there? I mentioned my former boss, Barry Lynn, who is a minister in the United Church of Christ. That is a Christian denomination, has Christ's name in it, but it's very progressive on politics. And it's, you know, pro-abortion rights, it's pro-gay rights, it's very much in favor of economic justice, but it's a Christian denomination. A government based on that version of Christianity would probably not find a lot of favor from a guy like Jerry Falwell Jr. or some of these Franklin Graham or some of these other very conservative Christian pastors that are out there.
Do you find that some of the people who express the concern that as a Muslim population increases in America, they raise the possibility of Sharia law coming into effect? Are these often people who might have no problem with law being based upon Christian concepts and precepts?
Well, that is ironic. A few years ago, the folks in Oklahoma passed some kind of a law to ban, you know, Sharia law. They were concerned about Sharia law. At the same time, they were putting Christian symbols and the Ten Commandments in the State House and all this other stuff that clearly was designed to promote their version of religion. A lot of this really, I think, is just people being afraid of the changing demographics of the country. In the 1950s, about 95% of the country identified with Christian denominations. That number now is at 70%, 70. So we are changing. But there's no reason to be afraid of that. We are a multi-faith, multi-philosophy society. We respect our diversity. We can all get along if we just understand that we all have the right to practice our religion or no religion. But you shouldn't expect the government to embrace your theology. The job of promoting theology belongs to religious organizations, not the government.
Rob Boston, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the communications director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, the group founded by Barry Lynn, as you've been hearing. He's appearing tonight at 7 o'clock at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Ashland, talking about defending our values, politics, and separation of church and state. We'll resume the discussion here on the Jefferson Exchange with the reminder that this is Spring Fund to Drive Time here on JPR, and we're looking for pledges of support. 888-552-6191 to pledge by phone or pledge online at ijpr.org. Thanks for listening to and supporting JPR. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about separation of church and state. In fact, we are talking to a group that has that very phrase in its name, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, based in Washington, D.C., focused solely, as the name implies, on church-state separation issues, founded by the Reverend Barry Lynn under new management now. Rob Boston is the communications director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and we'll be talking about the topics that his group deals with in a talk titled Defending Our Values tonight at 7 o'clock at the Rogue Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship Hall on 4th Street in Ashland. Free admission and brought here by the Jefferson Center, no relation to the Jefferson Public Radio. You can join us right here and now on the Jefferson Exchange. Lots to talk about at church-state separation issues always. 800-838-3760 on the phone. Emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from David in Roseburg. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rob Boston.
Oh, yeah, morning. I think one of the simplest things that really gets unsaid with much of the separation issue is budgets. If you think about tax day is coming up on April 15th, we all put our money into a common pot, and we expect our money to be spent wisely and honestly. And if some claim comes in, say, for example, some religion claims that the world is on the shoulder of Atlas and that Atlas needs some kind of itching powder to keep him to keep the earth steady, and the budget then goes toward itching powder to Atlas, how can you prove that? So I think unprovable budgets is really the issue, and it should always be the issue. I'm wondering, actually, if your guest is familiar with a book called, my brain is seizing up. It was written in 1824, and it was about kings that would come up with demands on the people that were, you know, tulipomania. Oh, Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. It was written in 1824 on Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. And it has a lot of discussion about mad kings and how they were spending the treasuries on things that could not be proven. But it basically how the kings would bankrupt their whole nations with these unprovable budgets.
All right. Thanks for that. Appreciate the call, David. So, Charles Mackey, you are familiar with the book?
I'm familiar with the book. Yeah, I mean, it's considered a classic in sort of how people can be drawn into sort of delusionary thinking. The interesting thing about that call, though, is the question of money, which I do think is very compelling, actually. In recent years, we have seen a move toward, so-called faith-based initiatives coming from the government, voucher plans to fund private religious schools. The tradition in the United States has always been that religion pays its own way. That's one thing that really separates us from a lot of European nations where there are church taxes or some type of government support for religion financially. And that's really what got people pretty angry back in the day. If you go back and look at the history of the founding period, what people were so angry about and led them to push for separation of church and state were church taxes. People were being forced to pay taxes to support religions that they did not believe in. And when Virginia disestablished its Anglican church, thanks to Jefferson and Madison, that was really one of the driving forces, this drive to end church taxes. And it kind of disturbs me to see church taxes asserting themselves today under a new language or a new form.
What is that new law? Who's proposing church taxes?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, faith-based initiatives, school voucher plans. Mm-hmm. This essentially takes government money, from the taxpayers and hands it out to religious organizations with very little control and very little oversight about how that is spent. And in the case of voucher plans, these are religious schools. They're teaching a theology. They may teach creationism instead of evolution. They may teach, bogus forms of history. They may teach anti-gay views, anti-women views, whatever. With their own money, I may disagree with that, but they certainly have the right. But increasingly in some states, we're seeing efforts to give them taxpayer money, which to me just means that everybody's paying to support those religious views.
You wrote about this a couple of days ago, Rob Boston. I was looking at your blog post on the Americans United for Separation of Church and State website. You wrote about a case in Kansas in particular. What were the specifics there?
Right. In Kansas, they were trying basically to look at funding schools through a voucher plan because they're under court order from their state Supreme Court to adequately fund the education system of the state. The Kansas Constitution actually contains language mandating that the education system be adequately funded. And some lawmakers were saying the way to do that was just to shut down the public school system and give out a bunch of vouchers for people to buy private education. Now, obviously, that's not going to be a viable solution for the vast majority of people. In this country, we need to remember, 90% of our young people are educated by public schools. So the focus really needs to be on that system.
Kansas in particular seems to garner a lot of attention for this and other reasons relative to taxation and spending and taxation and a whole relative range of things. Does that one state keep you busy in particular?
Well, it's one among several that keep us busy. There are certain parts of the country, and I don't want to stereotype by pointing out the Bible Belt is particularly problematic, but the fact is sometimes things do arise from those states that are very difficult. A number of southern states recently have been passing laws to post religious signs and slogans in public schools. They're trying to find end runs around the school prayer decisions from 1962 and 1963. You see the creationism bills oftentimes coming out of those states. It's challenging. We have obviously a very challenging environment right now at the federal level with the Trump administration. But we're also fighting a lot of things in the states as well. So it's just full time.
Well, I'm talking about religious displays, something kindled the memory of Roy's Rock when we were talking a few minutes ago. This is Roy Moore when he was the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, insisted upon this many hundred pound sculpture of the Ten Commandments in the lobby of the Supreme Court building, which he was ordered to take away and didn't, and finally it was carted away in the middle of the night. He was removed from the Alabama Supreme Court, only to return later, obviously, as a candidate for U.S. Senate. He ended up losing that. And I've watched this process in particular with displays of what people considered to be a historical view of law. And it seems like if you have the Ten Commandments and maybe the Code of Hammurabi or something, does that make it okay? But if it's just the Ten Commandments, it's not?
Yeah, actually, if you go down to the U.S. Supreme Court, if you're ever, in Washington, and you want to see a way to do this right, The main chamber of the U.S. Supreme Court is really interesting because along the wall there's a frieze that depicts the evolution of the law over many centuries. So they do include the Ten Commandments, but they also have the Code of Hammurabi, the Code of Justinian, Roman law, Napoleonic law, depictions of all these great lawgivers, ancient Greeks. And the purpose of that display is not to endorse one particular perspective, but to show how many sources have influenced our law over many centuries. So that's a good way to do it. What Roy Moore wanted to do was take the Ten Commandments, a two-ton rock with them carved on top, put it at the courthouse in Alabama, and say, this is the source of all of our law. Now, not only is that a church-state violation, it's just completely and utterly historically inaccurate because a lot of other sources affected the law.
Do you find that in the business you're in, asserting separation of church and state, though, you get into some fairly fine points, like you can't have a manger scene in a public building, but can you have a Christmas tree, that sort of thing?
Right, yeah. I mean, the courts are charged with the task of trying to sort this out. And over many decades, they've been doing that. And sometimes they hand down rules that may seem nonsensical to people, but if you think about it, maybe they make a little more sense. For instance, with Christmas displays. Yes, if you just have a manger scene alone by itself on the steps of City Hall, put there by the government, that's going to be a church-state violation. But the court has ruled if you add some secular elements to it, this is facetiously sometimes called the plastic reindeer rule. if you add some secular elements to it, like some reindeer, some Santa Claus, some Christmas trees, whatever, that you've taken what is primarily a religious display and made it more diverse. And that's all right. And also private groups can come in and they can put their displays up. So there are rules out there. They sometimes don't make a lot of sense at first glance. But if you look at them, at least there's an attempt there to, I think, respect separation yet allow people to have these displays.
Rob Boston is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the communications director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State based in Washington, D.C. I keep getting confused because his name is Boston, but he works in Washington. He's in Ashland and will be speaking tonight at the Rogue Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. In a talk titled Defending Our Values, Politics, and Separation of Church and State, you can join the conversation right here, right now on the Jefferson Exchange, always a very hot topic in America, 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Gene in Winston. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rob Boston.
Yes, hello. This is a question that's puzzled me for some time about the separation of church and state and the laws. How can the government make a law saying that Mormons can't practice polygamy? And then how can they, how about Sharia law? Like the Quran says if a Muslim renounces his faith and you're another Muslim, you're supposed to kill that person. And, you know, they have laws against, you know, killing homosexuals and stuff like that. And so how does that fit in with the law saying that there shall not be any laws prohibiting the exercise of faith?
That's a very good question. And, you know, if you think about it, the First Amendment's religious freedom provisions are only 16 words. So there's a real economy of words there. The drawback is that you have to really look and fill that in because obviously we can't have absolute, complete religious freedom where you can do whatever you want. You can't sacrifice a child before the sun god. You know, you cannot break other types of laws. In the case of Mormons and polygamy, that was before the Supreme Court in the late 19th century, and the court declared that polygamy could be barred because it was a threat to the larger social order. Now, we're seeing an echo of this discussion today and some of the fights that are before the Supreme Court right now involving, you know, bakers that don't want to make cakes for same-sex couples, people who own hotels and don't want same-sex couples to be in there, lots of different discussions like that. And I know there have even been cases like that here in Oregon. So the general rule has been that if your religious behavior, if your religious freedom infringes upon the rights of someone else, it can be curbed. It's kind of like the old saying, my right to swing my fist ends where your nose begins. If what I'm doing religiously is taking away the rights of someone else or causing them some kind of a harm, then there can be a restriction. Now, how far that goes, that's a very complicated question the court's been grappling with for a long time.
The issue of plural marriage, though, in particular, that Gene raises, I mean, this kind of gets to a discussion of how does that harm somebody else, as has been the case with same-sex marriages. Like, how does that harm somebody else? And ultimately, it came down to the court's view, it doesn't. So that's a particularly interesting one, I would think.
It is interesting. I mean, the Mormon cases are old cases. They're late 19th century, 1880s, 1890s. And the court, if you read those decisions, there's not a lot of analysis there. But I do think that the courts can look at a body of, I'd say, what you might call social issue studies to kind of determine about if there is harm from these practices. There have been a few existing polygamous communities in southern Utah that the government just kind of turned a blind eye toward, and they've been operating there for a while. And those communities are actually experiencing a lot of social dysfunction. So you could make that argument in a way that nobody ever could make with marriage equality or same-sex marriage. The conservative groups really tried to argue that there was some social problem with same-sex marriage, that it somehow created problems for child rearing or hurt larger society in some way, but they simply had no empirical evidence.
So what about religious practices that involve intoxicants? And I believe there's often some leeway given to Native American practices that existed before the Constitution did, things like peyote and ayahuasca and things that are hallucinogenic substances, but that are involved in what appeared to be ceremonies that existed a long time ago.
Right, exactly. There have been some cases involving that. In fact, it was a very prominent case from here in Oregon back in the 90s about this kind of thing. And the courts have generally sometimes allowed for types of usages of those things that normally would be considered a violation of the law because people are not, you know, selling it on the street or engaging in the types of activities that really present a harm to anybody outside certain insular communities. These are very interesting questions. And there have been, aside from the fact of the First Amendment and what it says, there have been federal laws passed attempting to deal with what religious freedom is and how it is to be expressed and how it is to be controlled, if necessary, by the government. And so we're looking at those as well. And it's something that the Supreme Court is looking at right now with this case from Colorado concerning the baker that didn't want to make a cake for the same-sex couple. That decision is due probably by the end of June. Depending on what it says, I think we may have a little bit of a clearer picture of where we are with this question of religious freedom and how far it goes.
These cases in particular are fascinating to watch because it gets to the realm of, like, did you make it voluntarily or not, doesn't it? I mean, because if they'd come in and just bought a cake that was sitting there, it would have been fine. Or the owner refusing to sell them a cake that already existed, that would have been a clear violation of law. But this whole custom-made, it's my artistry thing seems to confound
yes.
it further.
Yes. In this case, the court really is looking at it almost as a free speech argument than a pure church-state case. And you're right. This baker in this particular case has said, well, look, if they just wanted to come in and buy a tray of brownies or a ready-made cake that I had in the case, no problem. They wanted me to create a cake for them, and that's involving my artistic vision, and I don't have to do that. And, you know, the question almost becomes, is cake artistry a First Amendment-protected right like a writing would be or art or something, you know, the creation of creative art?
So it becomes it's First Amendment, but it's First Amendment in speech, not First Amendment in religion.
Yes, more of that is really what the court's looking at for this particular case.
But First Amendment in religion is the reason that people are passing things like the so-called Religious Freedom Restoration Act in Indiana. There was a federal law by the same name, too. And your organization appears to refer to these as discrimination in the name of religion.
Yeah, some of these Religious Freedom Restoration Acts at the state level have been very problematic. I mean, the federal one, less so, but in the states they have been because they opened the door to certain forms of discrimination. I mean, you might remember when that one was proposed in Indiana a few years ago, there was really quite a blowback to that.
And Mike Pence was the governor.
And Mike Pence, yeah. The thing that's concerned a lot of people is that folks remember Jim Crow. They remember what it was like for entire classes of individuals to be told, you can't come here. You can't be served here. We don't help, you know, we don't serve your kind. Nobody wants to go back to that in any context.
It seems like, wedding cakes aside, that a lot of the discussion of religious freedom ends up coming back to the whole issue of birth control and who provides it. And birth control has been common for years. What makes it such an issue now?
Yes, it's really remarkable what's happened here. I mean, in 1965, the Supreme Court, in a case called Griswold v. Connecticut, struck down a Connecticut law that curbed the sale of birth control and even doctors' rights to talk about it with patients. And we thought pretty much at that point that was settling the issue. You know, birth control it was becoming very common, and it obviously had positive benefits across society and empowered women to run their lives in ways that they hadn't been able to do before. Yet here we have, with the passage of the Affordable Care Act, since it mandated that birth control be part of these health care plans, some people began to resist that and said they weren't going to provide it. Now, I should be clear, the religious organizations were always exempt from that. If you're an employee of the Catholic Church, they don't have to provide birth control for you. There was always an exemption for religious groups. What happened is that secular businesses, for-profit companies, started demanding that same right. and owners were saying, well, I don't agree with birth control. I don't want my employees to have it.
And that led to the Hobby Lobby case?
To the Hobby Lobby case. And it's really, I think, created a rather odd situation where some corporations have been deemed to have religious freedom rights. I mean, that's been an individual right historically. To say that corporations can engage in religious activity, to me, it's very odd. It boggles the mind.
Does Americans United for Separation of Church and State employ lawyers?
Oh, yes. We have a pretty large legal staff, and we do a lot of litigating.
Okay. A lot to talk about still with Rob Boston, the Communications Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. A couple of phone calls waiting, but a few more phone calls we're seeking through another phone number, and that is through our Spring Fund Drive here on Jefferson Public Radio. We are on our way to what we hope is a $200,000 final goal. We stand at $63,050 at just the moment, and looking for 400 new members during the drive as well, somewhere around 100-plus at the moment, I believe. And we're going to ask you to send in your pledge of support, 888-552-6191, 888-552-6191, or you can pledge online at ijpr.org through a brand spanking new interface. Thanks for listening to Jefferson Public Radio. Thanks for your support through this fund drive. We'll come back and talk more to Rob Boston from Americans United for Separation of Church and State here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Rob Boston, the Communications Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Their name makes their mission rather clear. He is visiting Ashland for a talk tonight at the Rogue Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Ashland called Defending Our Values, Politics, and Separation of Church and State. That's tonight at 7. He's here now to take your questions and comments by phone, 800-838-3760, on and email jx@jeffnet.org. Here is a call from Jim in Grants Pass. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange with Rob Boston.
Yes, a very quick question that I've been asking, I think, since I was 60 years ago in school. Is any financial contribution to any church organization or anything still tax deductible or removable from your taxes, state or federal? And if that's still deductible, doesn't that mean that we all are financially involving ourselves in making a statement about a religion?
That's a good question. Thanks for that, Jim. Appreciate it.
Yes. Deductions to houses of worship, money given to houses of worship can be deducted. They're tax deductible. Now, that deduction is also made available to lots of other nonprofit organizations, universities, public radio stations, all kinds of groups out there can get that deduction as well. So it's not just a benefit given to religion. And although the Constitution actually doesn't say anything about tax exemption, as a matter of statute, that has been extended to lots of other types of organizations as well, universities, museums, literary societies, and so on.
But the general view of churches has been, you know, this is the way in which we are in our realm in politics and government, and you are in your realm in religion. There's no taxation, and no donation to directly from government to religion.
Historically that's been the case. Religion has paid its own way. That they've maintained their own properties. They paid for all their activities with voluntary contributions. Now, there is one thing about this we need to keep in mind: all nonprofit organizations in the United States, houses of worship, and all the other nonprofits as well, must follow a federal law that states you cannot intervene in politics by endorsing or opposing candidates. It's called the Johnson Amendment. Now, you can speak out on issues all you want, but you can't endorse or oppose candidates. So everybody's got to follow that law, and some groups seem to be having a little bit of trouble with that lately.
Well, you can see this circle written down here, support for candidates, because that has become a big issue where there's some chafing, it sounds like, on the right about whether or not churches can say explicitly who they're for or against in a political realm.
That's right. And I don't know who did it, but somebody got this into Donald Trump's head when he was a candidate, and this was going to be the issue he used to bring evangelicals over to his side. He began talking about how he was going to do away with that law, that he was going to totally destroy it at one time, he vowed to do. It is a law. It's passed by Congress in 1954. It's something that they have to repeal. We can't just issue an executive order and get rid of it. And actually, the poll shows a lot of people support this particular measure because they don't want to see their houses of worship politicized in that way.
Let's take some more phone calls. Wolfgang in Sunny Valley, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange with Rob Boston.
Good morning. This is a fascinating subject that's so much larger than you can cover in an hour or two or ten. One aspect strikes me. Looking at the history of churches in Europe, basically owning the land, owning the resources, being the capitalist in the literal sense of the word. And now you look at where the big money comes from to push right agenda, including all the trigger issues, right? I don't think it's the big money spenders are interested in abortion. They are interested in mobilizing a base that they can then turn into a conservative cum. Basically a machinery to let them pillage and rape whatever they want, get all the profits, destroy unions, do all the bad things.
So appeal to religion to mobilize essentially an army of voters.
Right.
All right. Thanks for that, Wolfgang. Thoughts, Rob?
Yeah. You know, I don't want to create the impression that religious organizations are always doing bad things, because actually they do a lot of good things. They provide a lot of services for people. They help the homeless. They serve people who are wrestling with addictions and so on. So they do a lot of good things. But there's also, I think, a temptation on the part of some religious organizations to think that because their particular theology is persuasive and true to them, that they want to push that out for kind of everybody to live under. And that's where we have to stand up and say, no, you know, in a multi-faith, multi-philosophy society, we're not going to base our public policy on a particular understanding of Christianity or the Bible or religion, because there's always going to be somebody else who's got a different perspective on that.
Wolfgang, with the European perspective, brings us back to some of the intentions of the founders, too, I would think. I mean, the fact is that religion was government in large parts of Europe still at the time that the Republic was founded here, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the founders were keenly aware of European history. I mean, they've come out of that tradition. And they knew about these instances where church had been over state, or state had been over church, or whatever, the struggle back and forth. Obviously, the conflict that arose, the Protestant Reformation, the violence, the wars, the bloodshed. They talked about that, and they wrote about that, and they were influenced by that. And they really wanted to keep that kind of fighting and that kind of violence from these shores as much as possible. And they saw separation of church and state as one of the ways to do that.
Let's take another call. Here's Ryan and Eugene. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange with Rob Boston.
Well, this is, as Wolfgang said, a very fascinating conversation. I would commend this to an ongoing theme, Jeffrey. But I do think the politics and confusing the battles of who's right politically versus who's right religiously is such a confounding topic. I mean, I'm really worried about that more and more every year as people find ways around that, and the prophets of the mega churches and all these things hardly seem religious any longer. I remember in the olden days, the Rolling Stones magazine had a little ad in the back saying, "Hey, fill out this form, send us $50, and we'll make you a church." I'm just curious about how you see that blending, that blurring of that line between the prophet. Oh, bad pun. Sorry. Profits and commercialism and actually being a religion.
Yeah, that's a very good question. In this country, we have tended to be very liberal in our definition of what constitutes a religion, and we've tended to err on the side of just assuming that if a belief is sincerely held, that that's really all you need to do. The only time that the state really kind of steps in and starts to kind of control or shut down religious activities is if they become illegal. I don't know if anyone's been watching this Netflix series that's on. It's actually about the Rajneeshis. Went here in Oregon back in the early 80s. Very fascinating series, because this group started out saying, "We just want religious freedom." They played that card constantly. "We just want the right to worship." But actually, they were engaged in quite a number of illegal activities, dangerous things, threatening to assassinate politicians, trying to poison people, all kinds of things that just you're not going to, you know, tolerate. So the government did come in and, in a very aggressive way, had to stop that. But that's an extraordinary case. Normally, religious groups have the right to collect as much money as they want. Their ministers can live in mansions. They can have fleets of fancy cars. They can fly jets all over the world. The government's really not going to step in and try to put a stop to any of that kind of stuff, even though to a lot of us that doesn't look much like the way Christ lived his life. But people have the right to make these determinations for themselves. And unless there's evidence of really clear law-breaking, the government usually adopts a pretty hands-off attitude. Sometimes that is to a detriment. I think the government could have been a little more aggressive, for example, in dealing with the clergy abuse scandal in the Roman Catholic Church. A lot of ministers there, a lot of pastors and priests and church officials were treated with a little too much deference, and as a result, it's been difficult for people who are victimized to get justice.
So there's a lot of freedom within the realm of religion, but then let's flip it around the other way, because I have heard people say that it's freedom of religion, not freedom from religion. Is there a fairly narrow space for non-believers?
See, I see that as those two ideas are not in conflict. In fact, they're two sides of the same coin. We all want to be free from religion under certain circumstances. If you're a very conservative Baptist, you don't want liberal Christianity being brought into your child's public school system. So everybody wants that at a certain level. But to sort of step back and take a larger look at it, the right to not believe, I think, must be protected just as the right to believe is protected, because a theory of religious freedom that did not include the right to reject all faiths would be of little value. And indeed, that is the way the First Amendment has been interpreted. It isn't just the right to pick a religion, but it's also the right to reject them all if that's the way you're going.
Rob Boston is the Communications Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. He's been at the organization since 1987. He also edits the AU's Church and State magazine. He's the author of four books, including Why the Religious Right is Wrong About Separation of Church and State and Taking Liberties, Why Religious Freedom Doesn't Give You the Right to Tell Other People What to Do. He'll be speaking tonight at 7 p.m. at the Rogue Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Ashland. That's at 4th Street, and that'll be 7 to 9 p.m. His talk is called Defending Our Values, Politics and Separation of Church and State. Rob Boston, a real pleasure. Thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.